In Genesis chapter 37, we need to go to also John 5, verse 45 and 46. We've got two chapters to cover. John 5, 45 and 46. We'll start now. The last section of the Bible is about Joseph. It's amazing. From 37 on to 50, it's Joseph. And John chapter 5, verse 45, it says, "Do not think that I will accuse you to the Father." This is Jesus speaking. "There is one that accuses you, even Moses, in whom ye trust. For had ye believed Moses, you would have believed me, for he wrote of me." That's funny. When Moses was writing about people in the Old Testament, he was actually writing about who? He was predicting the Messiah. He was describing characteristics of the Messiah. And one of the best descriptions of the Messiah is found in a young boy named Joseph. There's perhaps no other individual found in the Scriptures that presents a more vivid picture of the Lord Jesus Christ than does Joseph. All the incidences that occurred in his life are pictures of events in the life of Christ. Over and over, the Bible reveals to the reader the humanly character and attributes of Jesus in the ways that Joseph conducted himself in very similar situations. It's funny, the life of Joseph parallels the life of Jesus. Each detailed event that Joseph endured pointed to some episode also in the life of Jesus. In a world where hero worship abounds, Joseph stands head and shoulders alone and above all the rest. Consider some of these areas where Joseph made lasting and internal impressions. Are we all together on the page? We're going to be one. As a role model for teens, he did not give in to fighting with his brothers and sisters. Right? You don't have to tear apart your family just because somebody hurts your feelings. He conducted himself with virtues that are lacking in many married adults. And refused the lustful intention of a woman in position. I just read of a pastor in Alabama, a black pastor, who had 80-some-odd people in his church, and he abused the privilege of a pastor, and he took advantage of several married women, and he himself had HIV. And he has now come, and the church has tried to lock him out and tried to block him from being their pastor, but he will not step down. This wicked, wicked, not even a man. He may be male, but he's not a man. And this pastor took advantage of the women in his church who were married. You know, Joseph teaches you, you do not have to use opportunities. I don't care if the women wanted him. I mean, he's an ugly guy. But I don't care if a woman thinks you're handsome and wonderful. You can refuse the lustful intention of a woman in power. Number three, he's a role model for the businessman. In that he made wise investments. Look at this. When you look at the life of Joseph, you see an example that applies to dozens of areas of life. Number four, he's a role model for politicians. In that he would not take bribes. If there's such a thing as a role model for prisoners, Joseph is one. If there's a role model for being a slave, Joseph is the head of the list. Candidates for revenge will have to look elsewhere to find an excuse to execute revenge on those that have wronged them. Joseph had every opportunity to inflict revenge, but he chose to forgive. Joseph is a role model for the Christian in that he lived a life of faith and he had no written Bible to read. Wow, you and I have such a blessing having a written Bible to read, check, verify. He didn't have a Bible. All he had to lay claim to were the promises made to his father and his father's father and to his people. He always gave wise counsel to anyone who asked him a question. And in each position he occupied, he sought to elevate the one above him. Powerful, powerful thing. If there was ever a human hero worthy of the title hero recorded in the pages of history, it is beyond any doubt the man Joseph. And he's the 11th son of Jacob. As Joseph and the conflicts he endured or studied, Christians should be more mindful of the spiritual strength that Joseph had. The same God that kept Joseph is the same God that keeps you and I. The Lord appeared to Joseph's father, to his grandfather and great-grandfather, in visions, dreams, and man to man. But the Bible does not say that the Lord appeared in either of these manners directly to Joseph. And yet Joseph was the best of them all. Regardless, Joseph's life manifested abundant faith in the Lord. Now, he lived to the ripe old age of 110. I want to live to be 103, but Joseph lived to be 110. Here's our study lesson. Let's start in verse 1, 2, 3, and 4. Francis, would you read Genesis chapter 37, 1 to 4?
Jacob built those in the land wherein his father was a stranger in the land of Canaan. These are the generations of Jacob, Joseph being 17 years old.
Right, how old was he just by accident? Just when I stopped you, how old was he?
17.
He's 17. Yeah, that's a teenager, isn't it? He's still a teenager, isn't he? How old are you, Francis? You're 14, all right? So he's just 3 years older than you. Look at what this guy is like. Go ahead.
Was feeding the flock with his brother, and the lad was with the sons of Bilhah, and with the sons of Zilpah, his father's wife, and Joseph got unto his father their evil report. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children, because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a coat of many colors. And when his brethren saw that their father loved him more than all his brethren, they hated him and could not speak discipline unto
him. Wow, okay. So Joseph's home life, as you're filling there on A, Joseph's home life. Joseph lived in the land of Canaan. C-A-N-A-A-N. He's living in the promised land, also known as the sinful land. Okay? Because there's a lot of stuff going on there. Joseph is 17 years old. He's born while Jacob lived back there with Laban. He was born back with Laban. His mother's name was Rachel. His name means adding. And as Joseph was born later in his life, he didn't see and was not involved in the fighting between Jacob and Laban. Perhaps that's why his elder brothers fought so much, was because of the environment they were raised in. You never know how much your influence. I read about, every kid's responsible for how they are. You grow up, I don't care if your parents divorced, I don't care if your parents fought or whatever, you have to do right. But you cannot deny that things in your home affect you. You are a reflection of how your parents were. So maybe his older brothers are a reflection of living in that home where Jacob constantly complained about Laban. Number three, he was a sheep herder, or what we call a shepherd. That's the shortened term for a sheep herd, a shepherd, just as Abel was, and Moses, and David, and Jesus Christ. They were all shepherds. Number four, he was also a tattletale. Is that an Irish word? What do you call a tattler in Ireland? What's the word for a tattletale? Huh?
Squealer.
A squealer? He squealed on me!
A rat.
A rat, yeah. Yeah, I've heard that.
That's a more modern one. It's more, conveys more viciousness.
It's right. Oh, yeah. I won't rat on my friends, they say. Yeah. Well, that's what he was. He goes home to daddy and he tells the evil report of what his brothers are doing. Number five, Joseph was loved most by Jacob. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Kind of bad thing.
It's a kind of very bad thing because it affects the other children. Jacob should have learned this lesson. Instead, he elevates Joseph above the rest of his family and above the rest of his brothers. Who, between Jacob and Esau, who was loved more by his daddy?
Esau
was loved by Isaac more. And Isaac, Jacob should have known, I can't have a favorite because I saw what it did to my home. There he was doing the very same thing. So be careful. If your dad was a drunk and you say, I would never drink, believe me, if you're not careful, you'll turn out just as bad, if not worse, than your dad if you don't walk with God. That's sin in us. See, Jacob made Joseph an exquisite coat of many colors. This produced hatred in his brothers, which in turn stops them from even being able to love him and speak anything. Every time they got around him, they tore him to bits. They couldn't find it in them to be nice to him. Number six, the problems in Jacob's family so far are their father's been very rebellious. You see the love of Joseph above all the other family members, the hatred by the brothers. There were superiority complexes. Here comes Joseph. Now, do you think Joseph was humble? Listen, when you compare Joseph with Jesus, Joseph's not perfect. So not in every area is Joseph. So when he puts on that robe, and it is a stunningly beautiful robe, when he walks among his brothers, do you think he's sort of ashamed of having this beautiful robe? Or is he letting it flow? I mean, there is a superiority complex in Joseph that his brothers hate. There is envy that's guiding all the interaction. Envy is one of the root sins. We talk about pride, but envy is in there. Lucifer envied God, didn't he? Cain envied Abel and the attention that God gave to Abel. The Pharisees envied Jesus. And most people in our lives live in envy of other people. They live in envy. If you had an iPhone 6, guess what everybody would say? And if you pulled it out to answer the phone, everybody would go, "Oh, that's an iPhone 6. It just does it. Everybody just naturally envies. "Oh man, what's it like? You like it? Oh, wish I had one." Maybe not Barry. Barry's still using one that you have to hand crank. His home life was one of constant deception. Now, they always acted like they loved one another in front of Daddy. Oh, listen, they didn't let Daddy see them hate Joseph, so they were deceiving him. When they did get rid of Joseph, they acted like it was an animal that had killed him. Even after 20 years, when they finally do meet up with Joseph, they have a hard time being honest about what happened in the past. This is a home life. I want you to show you the home life that Joseph grew up in. They didn't know how to be real. They didn't know how to forgive anything. Now, B, Joseph has some dreams. Edward, if you'll read 5 to 12.
"And Joseph dreamed a dream, and he told it his brethren, and they hated him yet the more. And he said unto them, 'Hear, I pray you, this dream which I have dreamed. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf arose, and also stood upright. And behold, your sheaves stood round about, and made obeisance to my sheaf.' And his brethren said to him, 'Shall thou indeed reign over us, or shall thou indeed have dominion over us?' And they hated him yet the more for his dreams and his words. And he dreamed yet another dream, and told it to his brethren, and said, 'Behold, I have dreamed a dream more, and behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars made obedience to me.' And he told it to his father and his brethren, and his father rebuked him and said unto him, 'What is this dream that thou hast dreamed? Shall I and thy mother and thy brethren indeed come to bow down ourselves to thee to the earth?' And his brethren envied him, but his father observed the saying. And his brethren went to feed their father's flock in Shechem. And Israel said unto Joseph, 'Do not thy brethren feed the flock in Shechem? Come, and I will send thee unto them.' And he said to him, 'Here am I.' And he said to him, 'Go, I pray thee, see whether be well with thy brethren and well with the flocks, and bring me word again.' So he sent him out of the vale of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. And a certain man found him, and behold, he was wandering in the field. And the man asked him, say, what seekest thou? And he said, I seek my brethren to tell me, I pray thee, where they fill their flocks. And the man said, they are departed hence, for I heard them say, let us go to Dothan.
Hold on. You're just supposed to start at 12.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay. All right. I just let you. Okay. Now we're on Joseph's dreams. Now, I want you to see Joseph's birth order. He is... let's do this. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 older brothers than Joseph at this point. Who's the last son born to Jacob?
Benjamin.
All right. So, we have little Joseph here, and Joseph is saying that all of these sheaves, now a sheaf is a bundle of stalks of wheat, or rye, we're not sure, it may be wheat, or maybe rye, or barley, or whatever, but these sheaves are standing up, and then in a moment, they're all bending over around and bowing in obeisance or in servitude, in honor of one sheaf, and that's young Joseph in the middle. And he's got this dream of all of these bundles of wheat or barley all bowing. I don't know if I got 11 there, Rana, or 10 of them. They're all surrounding him. And then he describes another dream, and he says, the sun, the moon, and 11 stars are bowing in honor of me. Now, is Joseph imagining that this might be hurting his brothers? That this might be embarrassing them? The oldest brother is looking at his youngest brother, distant brother, looking at number 11 and saying, this is not possible that now there's one other brother. Who's the youngest brother of them all?
Benjamin.
So there's one more kid brother.
Was he born at that time?
He's born at this time. All right.
He was 17.
Rachel died. Yeah, he's 17 years old. Rachel died in Bethlehem, okay, giving birth to Benjamin. She wanted to name him Benoni. So you've got, this is the 12th brother, all right? So here you got now all 11 stars, including Benjamin, are going to bow down before, and the sun and the moon. Who does the dad know that Joseph is describing? The dad, the mom, who is a reflection of the dad, like the moon is a reflection of the sun, and then the 11 other stars are going to bow down and honor me. Can you imagine that, guys? Boy, you talk about pain. Yes, sir.
How come he dreamed of the moon? It represents his mother, like his mother was dead, because his mother couldn't fall down.
All I can say is this was a prophetic dream of the future. His mom's going to be resurrected. Okay? Here's Abraham. I can only explain it this way. Abraham told his servants, the lad and I are going to go up to Mount Moriah and we worship God and we will return to you. I don't think he knew what he was saying. I don't think he knew exactly how it was going to happen. And all he knows is that people aren't done away with. And I think God is revealing something that Joseph doesn't understand, how his mother would still honor him. I don't know. But he just says it. He says, the sun and the moon.
It's like, you know, when Jacob interprets the dream as that's the sun and the moon is him and his mother, you think maybe his interpretation was incorrect and that means something else.
I don't really think it means something else. It's not possible for it to mean something else because he knows the sun must mean him. There's not another that is his wife, unless you want to make that Leah. But Jacob, I don't think he's making a wrong interpretation. I think he's understanding there's one thing. Listen, these things belong to the Jews, and Jacob is a Jew of a Jew. And he says, shall I and thy mother, it has to be, that it can't be Leah, it has to be Rachel. All right, so it's not corrected, and I don't see any place in the Bible where God corrects that interpretation. This has to be his brothers. These are his brothers. This has to be his brothers, because this part we know does happen when?
When
they go to Egypt and they end up bowing before him, and they don't know that it's him. Are you going to say something?
No.
Okay, all right. So, the interpretation, when God gives two visions, and they one helps you interpret the second one. Okay? And that's why why Pharaoh gets two dreams, one of cows and the other one of ears of corn. And Joseph, again, knows two dreams. They both are the same, even though they describe two different things. So whatever this is, that is with two more added things about his mother and his father. All right, so we're in Joseph's dreams. So you get his birth order. And now Joseph's dreams only cause more hatred. There are two dreams. One's of sheaves. Sheaves, S-H-E-A-V-E-S. We sing a song, it's written in him, Bringing in the Sheaves, which is talking about soul winning. Sheaves. And the second one's of stars. You need to remember these things because they'll be on your tabs. Alright. Stars. And he's saying that his little star is going to outshine not just other stars. You know, if you looked in the sky, there are several stars that are very bright. One of them is called Vega. The constellation Lyra, and there's another star called Sirius next to Orion, and it's one of the brightest stars in the sky. There are lots of bright stars, but Joseph is saying his star was going to be brighter than all stars. It's even going to be brighter than the sun. All right, now this is a powerful thing. I'm going to actually give you a head start, Barry. Joseph's not seeing himself. Even though he sees himself and his brothers honoring him, Joseph is not watching a vision of himself being honored. Joseph never outshines the sun. Jesus does. This is a prophecy that reaches far beyond the life of Joseph. He's speaking where the 12 tribes, and even Jacob and Isaac and even Abraham will bow before somebody in the future, and that's Jesus. Okay, so that's how I know that this is a resurrection promise of his mom one day bowing. It was just hard for them to understand. It's hard for us to understand unless we understand it in light of Jesus Christ. So we go down, jump down. I got all kinds of things. What does Rome think the moon represents? And Mary standing over, what does she have on her head when she's standing? You see these idols. It's got Mary, and she's standing on the head of the snake. She's got a crown with the sun, the moon, and the stars on her head. And Mary doesn't deserve that at all. Mary's not crushing anybody. It has to be Jesus, okay, who is superior. Just jumping down, number C, Joseph's got some troubles. It's Barry. Barry, if you'll read 13, all the way down to 36.
Sorry, can you go back to 6B?
Stars.
God's given a clear interpretation then. To Rome, the woman is Mary. Protestants, the woman is a
Protestant church.
To get that.
Ooh.
Okay, some of the rest of
Protestants, yeah, we're talking about Revelation chapter 12. The Protestants, if you talk to Mr. Ian Paisley,
who's dead?
Huh?
He's dead?
I know he's dead. But if you talk to him, I hope you haven't lately. The historical Calvinistic Protestant view of that woman is just a Catholic. It's a Protestant church marching throughout history and defeating the devil's work. And that's how come he took it very serious that he had to stay active both politically and religiously in order to stop the onslaught of the Catholic Church. And I appreciate what he's trying to do, but that's not what Revelation says.
Where's Revelation?
I go to Revelation chapter 12. Well, I thought you had the entire Bible memorized by now. You disappoint me. Revelation chapter 12, verse 1, and there appeared a great wonder, something amazing in heaven. A woman clothed with the sun, the moon under his feet, and upon her head was a crown of 12 stars. Now, why are there only 11 stars here? Because the 12th was Joseph, as far as he was concerned. And the 11 other stars, let's just call him Joe, the 11 other stars are all
bowing to him.
Bowing to him. Okay? So, here you've got a woman with 12 stars, so she's even superior to Joseph. And she, being with child, cried, travailing in birth, and pain to be delivered, there appeared another wonder in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns upon his head. And this woman here is the nation of Israel. She comprises all of that. That's Israel, because she includes Joseph. Right? If this is not the church, this is not Mary, this is Israel. To a Protestant, God did away with the Jews. To a Catholic, God does not deal with the Jews. God deals with the church. Both of them are wrong. God still has a plan for Israel. And God will use Israel as a nation. Again, it still is. He's doing it even today.
So, remember, I come from a very different culture, which Protestant, there's two types of Protestant, political and then there's a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
But the Protestant you're talking about, would that include like Methodists and Presbyterians?
I speak in general terms. Generally, Protestants, Presbyterian, I'm not going to say all free Presbyterians, but Calvinistic, Arminianistic, Calvinistic, amillennialistic Protestants believe that God is done with the Jews and that the prophecies in Revelation that deal with the conquering of the devil are through the church, the Protestant church. The Catholic says that God is all through with Israel and God's going to conquer the sins of the world and the problems of the world through the Catholic church. Both churches are wrong. God conquers it through the nation of Israel, because through Israel, Jesus was born. He is a Jew. And it is through Israel's fall that Gentiles have been allowed to get saved. And when the Jews are restored, how much better things will be. So it's always through Israel, not through the church. The church is just a mechanism to preach the gospel, but we're not Savior. It's the Jews. Salvation is of the Jews, John chapter 4 says. Not of the Christians and not of the church. That may be a fine point, but in your mind, you've got to realize Protestants think it's the Protestant church that is what the world needs. The Catholics say it's the Catholic church that the world needs. And I go, no, what we need is for Israel to be restored back, because that's God's clock. That's God's people. And if you turn your back on God's people, God turns his back on you. That is a prophecy of the nation of Israel once again being active and being protected by God. That's what Revelation chapter 12 is. I'm just telling you, if you picked up a Protestant, I'd say generally, if you picked up a book by a normal North Ireland Protestant, general, I don't can't be specific, they would come through and do Revelation, and all of these things are in the past. And if there's any future, they'll say, that is the Protestant church. And you go, what? It is not. It is Israel. Yes, sir.
You're just referring to scholars, or like, I mean, I know when
commentators,
or whatever he wants, he says, you know, that he doesn't know people that believe that up in Northern Ireland or things like that.
Amen. And I'm glad.
I don't know any Catholics that believe that it's Mary, because I don't know any Catholic scholars. You know, sort of idea, but I know that the Catholic Church on a whole, but if you asked everyone in Ballincollig who was Catholic, they would know
it all. Anyway. Exactly.
So it's
theologians more than anything.
It is. It's the leaders sometimes, and the theologians, yes. Yeah.
But it's just the culture in the north, anyway, because there's Protestant political, there's Protestant Northern Irish, there's Protestant Lutheran.
I know.
Most Protestants, if you're talking in general, see themselves as Reformation Protestants.
Right.
Well, I say the Christians see themselves, including Baptists, Calvinists.
I know.
They would see themselves as Reformation Protestant?
All I would ask,
in the true sense,
I don't care whether Protestant, Catholic, Baptist, Methodist, or whatever, ask them, what do you do with Israel? And based on their response to Israel, I can tell you what they think about the church. If they say God is through with Israel, they believe that God replaced Israel with their religious organization. So when they come to something that refers to Israel, oh, it means the church. It means a Protestant church if they're Protestant. Oh, it means a Catholic church if they're Catholic. That's what they think. Because once you've gone away with Israel, you have to replace it. And if I was a cult leader, I would say, oh, that's us. That's our power one day, conquering the devil, fighting the devil, God protecting us as we have to flee. Go away. It's wrong. It's wrong. I don't have to flee. Don't have to at all. That's Israel fleeing during the tribulation, not the church. Does that make sense? Do you understand what I'm saying? So it's based on their, what is their attitude? If they are standing with Israel, praying for Israel, deciding to send aid to Israel and keeping them militarily, politically powerful in the Middle East, then Israel, then you've kept Israel in its place.
When you're saying about the Catholic Church, the Protestant Church here, it's kind of a revelation to me. And even this year in 12, what does it say? Because I never actually made that connection before.
Amen. Well, you just respond. Amen.
I don't know if I understand it all.
All right, number C. Joseph's troubles. Go ahead there, Barry.
And Israel said unto Joseph, do not thy brethren feed the flock in Shechem? Come, and I will send thee unto them. And he said to him, here am I. And he said to him, go, I pray thee, see whether it be well with thy brethren, and well with the flocks, and bring me word again. So he sent him out of the vale of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. And a certain man found him, and behold, he was wandering in the field. And the man asked him, saying, what seekest thou? And he said, I seek my brethren. Tell me, I pray thee, where they feed their flocks. And the man said, they are departed hence, for I heard them say, let us go to Dothan. And Joseph went after his brethren and found them in Dothan. And when they saw him afar off, even before he came near unto them, they conspired against him to slay him. And they said one to another, behold, this dreamer cometh. Come now therefore, and let us slay him, and cast him into some pit. And we will say, some evil beast hath devoured him, and we shall see what will become of this dream.
All right, hold there for a second. What did they want to do to their brother?
Good.
All right. Remember, what does it say? If any man hate his brother, he is a what? First John. He's a murderer. So, well, I hate some people, but I would murder them. If you had the opportunity, if there was nobody who could catch you and could put you in jail, you'd murder them. They didn't just say, oh, I hate my brother. They said, let's kill him. And we'll say that these are his own brothers. Aren't you glad you don't have one of those? Okay, keep going. I just want you to get the air of this text here.
And Reuben heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands, and said, let us not kill him. And Reuben said unto them, shed no blood, but cast him into this pit that is in the wilderness, and lay no hand upon him, that he might rid him out of their hands to deliver him to his father again.
All right, so who's the good guy of the 12?
Reuben.
All right, now Reuben's actually the oldest. Okay, he actually says, we can't kill him, all right. So keep going.
And it came to pass, when Joseph was come unto his brethren, that they stripped Joseph out of his coat of many colors that was on him. And they took him and cast him into a pit, and the pit was empty. There was no water in it. And they sat down to eat bread, and they lifted up their eyes and looked, and behold, a company of Ishmaelites came from Gilead, with their camels bearing spicery and balm and myrrh, going to carry it down to Egypt. And Judah said unto his brethren, what profit is it if we slay our brother and conceal his blood?
Ooh, this is the beginning of... Hey, what kind of money can we make off of our brother? We can't make any money off of him if we kill him. Right. I mean, how mean if they reduce your value to some coins. Go ahead.
Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh, and his brethren were content. And there passed by Midianites, merchantmen, and they drew and lifted up Joseph out of the pit, and sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver. And they brought Joseph into Egypt. And Reuben returned unto the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit, and he rent his clothes. And he returned unto his brethren and said, the child is not, and I, whither shall I go? And they took Joseph's coat and killed a kid of the goats, and dipped the coat in the blood. And they sent the coat of many colors, and they brought it to their father, and said, this have we found. Know now whether it be thy son's coat or no. And he knew it, and said, it is my son's coat. An evil beast hath devoured him. Joseph is without doubt rent in pieces.
Hold there for a second. John was saying it earlier in the week. What's the best way of teaching and getting people to believe something? By letting them connect the dots and conclude on their own. So they sent the thing and said, is this your son's? They're playing it up. Could this coat be your son's? There, really. So that the father goes, this is my son. And the father deduces.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
And Jacob rent his clothes and put sackcloth upon his loins and mourned for his son many days. And all his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, for I will go down into the grave unto my son mourning, thus his father wept for him. And the Midianites sold him into Egypt unto Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh's and captain of the guard.
Joseph's troubles begin. From here on out, Joseph was going down in status. Joseph goes from being the favorite son, adorned with many colors, close at Jacob's side. And he goes out to where his brethren were. He first goes to Shechem, and they're not there. So he goes further afield, seeking his brethren. They keep moving away. Shechem was 40 miles away from where Jacob was at that time. Francis, if your dad said, let's see, how far is 40 miles away from Cove? Maybe Macroom? Maybe is that far enough? Would have to be beyond Macroom?
20 miles.
Can you imagine walking from Cove, Francis, all the way through Cork, through Ballincollig, beyond Macroom to go looking for your brother and sister? And that's how his dad said, go find your brothers. And he walks 40 miles. They're not there. They're not at Shechem. And a guy says, oh, I heard him say they're going to to Dothan. And he then walks 10 more miles to go to Dothan.
Interesting, no time given there?
No, it's taken a week for him to go find him. I mean,
maybe more. I mean, how does he know to go in that direction?
Well, I bet they know. He's not walking in kind of any crazy area. He knows the direction. Follow the sheep's poo. Who knows? As a naive brother, see, he just wants to be around his brethren. But he is completely rejected by him. They conspire against Joseph. They wanted to kill him. And ultimately, they decide to send him away into slavery. From this moment on, as far as they're concerned, he would never be freed and he would never return. As far as he was concerned, when he's sold away, he doesn't ever imagine he'd ever see his family again. He's sold into slavery. As the brothers were eating, they looked and they saw a caravan. Judah thought of a way to make money. So he suggested to sell Joseph. And isn't Judah, you might see that word? Judah. Isn't that unusual that Judah says, let's sell him. Sell Joseph. And then you got an apostle, a disciple, named Judas, which is the Greek word for the same name. He says, let's sell Jesus. One guy gets for 20 pieces, 20 coins, and Jesus is sold for how many?
30.
All right. So now begins the parallels. Whew, Judah and Judas. All right. So, number two, the merchantmen are a mixed lot. Once they purchased Joseph, the caravan was made up of three races of people. Jew, Joseph, Arabs, Ishmaelites, and Midianites. Gentiles. Now Jacob is deceived, just as Jacob deceived his father, Isaac, regarding his identity. Do you remember that? Remember when Jacob deceived his father? How did he show up? He showed up with fur and skin. He tried to conceal his voice, but he's trying to convince his daddy that he was who?
Esau.
That he was Esau. Just as he deceived his father, his own sons are trying to deceive him. All right, you know what the Hindus call that? Karma. You get what you deserve.
What we call it in Ireland, what goes around comes around.
There you go. So just as Jacob deceived his father Isaac regarding his identity the day he stole the birthright from Esau, he now is deceived by 10 of his children. The brothers kill a kid goat and dip Joseph's coat of many colors in that blood. Now, the brothers refer to Joseph as Jacob's son, but not their brother. Is this the blood of your son? What a stab. The brothers take the evidence to Jacob that Joseph is dead. They didn't even think enough of him to refer to him as their brother. The Jews refer to Jesus as anything but God's son. It is recorded about 30 times that Jesus was referred to as this man. That's how they talked about him. You know, Jesus was a Jew, wasn't he? And they should have referred to him as, this is our brother. This is a fellow Jew. But no, they go, and this man. If you ever are faithful and being a gospel witness and just trying to live for God, people will go, that man. That's how they refer to you. They won't even consider you an equal. Context of each determines whether it was a derogatory or a praiseworthy remark. I find no fault in him. speaking of Jesus, it was a praiseworthy wrong. But the day the Lord Jesus died, there was one man, the Roman centurion, that acknowledged that this man truly was the Son of God in Mark 15:39. Number two, Jacob mourned. He believes the worst has happened for his beloved son. And you know, when Jesus died, the father mourned as well and turned his back on his son. It is one thing to be sold into slavery. It's another thing to be thought of as dead. I read of there were many in World War I and World War II, but more in World War II we're aware of, many men who were taken prisoner by the Chinese, by the Japanese and the Germans. And for years during the war, they were never allowed to communicate with their families. So what did the families figure? They were dead. And after the war was over, slowly those missing in action were able to come home. Can you imagine the shock to those wives and parents to find out their son was still alive? It must have been fantastic. But that's kind of how it's going to turn out to be in the end. Number F, he was sold to Potiphar. Potiphar was a general. Each step that Joseph takes leads to a further disaster in his life. So he steps first from a family. From that family, he's sold into slavery. Really, he's not even sold into slavery yet. He's first sold into a caravan, sort of intermarried, but ultimately he is sold into slavery. Let's just go ahead and say there's slavery. And then from slavery, where is he going from there? He's going to end up in prison. What would you think your life's doing at that point? How would you feel about God and your faith?
He's angry.
Angry, frustrated, like, this isn't working. I mean, we're the prosperity preachers then, amen? Good night. So, let's keep going. Yet each step leads him in the will of God. Look at Genesis 45, and Eric, would you read Genesis 45, verses 5, 6, and 7?
These 2 years have the family.
No, 45, verse 5, 6, and 7.
Genesis 45?
Mm-hmm.
Look, no. I'm looking at 45, 6, and 7.
Verse 5, 6, and 7.
Now therefore be not grieved or angry with yourselves that ye sold me hither, for God did send me before you to preserve life. For these 2 years have the family been in the land.
Famine
been in the land. And yet there are 5 years in the which there shall neither be ear nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve you a posterity in the earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance.
All right. So this was all, it looks like his brothers, but it was God. And that's how a Christian has to start seeing things. Even though his brothers took him and threw him into slavery, and from there he ends up in prison, it was God. And, you know, the quicker you learn that God's in control and not your brothers, the happier you will be. Joseph has absolutely no idea what God is doing until later, and yet, he still does right. Why? Because he has what you need, and I need, is a personal walk with God, not a last-minute thing, but something he already had in operation. B, he had a hope. What did God give him before he went down that path? John, gave him dreams. So God sometimes will show you, this is what I'm going to do. And that's why knowing the call of God, the will of God helps you. Because when you say, all right, God gave me something. I'm just not living from day to day. I'm living already in heavenly places. I'm already living in the spiritual blessings, even though I don't have them right now. And that is what Joseph had. And he had his life that he could live for God no matter what the circumstances. As long as he was breathing, he could live for God. Now look at some of the Joseph similarities with Jesus Christ. I just list, how many do I have here? 32. Somebody once said there were 300. I haven't found them all. These are 32 of my favorite ones. I think I found 70, maybe more, similarities. But there's a book out there, and I wanted to get it. It's of the 300 similarities between Joseph and Jesus. I'd like to get it. The whole book just on those, that would blow me away. Number one, both Joseph and Jesus were loved above his brethren by his father. Both of their brethren, both Jesus' brothers and Joseph's brothers, hated them. As a matter of fact, Jesus' brothers wanted Jesus dead, wanted to go down to Jerusalem because they knew that for envy, the Pharisees hated him and they wanted him to go down there and be killed. Number three, they both were stripped of their coat and their clothes. Remember when they stripped Jesus of his only thing he owned, which was his simple robe. Joseph was sold for 20 pieces of silver. Jesus was sold for 30. The Lord was with Joseph in everything he did, as God the Father was with Jesus. Jesus was tempted at all points as we are, as was Joseph. Was Joseph tempted?
Yeah.
Listen to me something. What was Joseph tempted to do? I mean, sometimes we think of only certain kinds of sins. Eric, can you do something? Ah, good. He was tempted to take
Jesus
revenge.
Was, woohoo! Said, to call down the angels.
Yes. To free him. What else, John?
Escape.
Okay. I don't think. I mean, I'm sure he was tempted to escape. I like that. He just never could.
If all of that was God's will, then if you think about a Christian's life, we often want.
Love it. I never thought about that. Mm. Romeo, what do you think Jesus was? What was Joseph tempted to do?
No idea.
He was tempted to commit adultery. Not with prison. He went to prison because Potiphar's wife tried to get him to commit adultery. And he, believe me, he was tempted. When she starts to undress in front of him and she says, "No one's in the house, no one will know." When he turns and she grabs him, he jumps out of his clothes and he runs out naked because that temptation was powerful, but he was tempted. What else was he tempted? What do you think, Francis? If you've done nothing but see everything in your life fall apart, you've lost your family, you've lost your life, your freedom, how would you feel? What would you be tempted to do? You'd be tempted to quit. I'm not praying anymore. I'm not worshiping God anymore. I quit. Believe me, he had that temptation. And Jesus was tempted in all points as well. All right? Number seven, it cost Joseph and Jesus everything to do right. In Genesis 39, when it talks about him leaving Potiphar's wife, what did it cost him? It cost him his clothes. It cost him his position that he had worked so hard to get to. It cost him his name. From that moment, his name was a rapist, an adulterer. His name was only known as a criminal. It cost him everything. And when Jesus did his will, what did everybody call him? Look at him. That fraud. This is not the Son of God. He's not the King of the Jews. They maligned him. It cost Jesus everything to go to the cross. Both Jesus and Joseph were shepherds. I encourage you, you need to look at some of these things because you'll need to know a bunch of them to list on your exam. All right, let's go to chapter 38. This is chapter 38. Now we move to a man named Judah. Look at him. He does not do well. This is one of those sad chapters in the Bible. There's plenty of them. One of them is with Simeon and Levi and Dinah and the sin there. Now we're going to deal with the sins of Judah. Look at Matthew chapter 1 and verse 3. John, would you read Matthew chapter 1, verse 3?
And Judas begat Phares, and Zara of Tamar, and Phares begat Ezra, and Ezra begat Aaron.
Okay. Judah.
We got Judah. He begat
two sons. Right? What are their names?
Perez and Hezron. Perez begat Hezron then. Judah, Perez and Judas begat Perez and Zarah.
Yeah, Perez. Is there a Z on the end?
An S in this one.
Oh, okay. Perez, and what's the next one? And
Zarah. Z-A-R-A.
Yeah, Zarah. Okay. So Judah produced, but of who?
Tamar.
Of a woman named Tamar. Alright? Alright, we're going to learn about Tamar here, where she comes in. This narrative leaves Joseph temporarily and introduces the sins of Judah, as you fill in. Judah parted company with his brothers after they had sold Joseph. He goes down, physically and spiritually, and he marries a Canaanite woman. His actions cost him dearly. This chapter actually fits right after chapter 33 and fills you in on internal family affairs in Jacob's family while they lived in Canaan. This chapter's two main topics. One, the Levirate marriage, where a Levirate marriage is the marriage of a widow to the brother of her deceased husband. It was a Levitical law that if here's this woman and she's married and her husband dies, her brother should now marry her. His brother, so the brother of that man, should now marry her.
Or if she has no kids, huh?
Maybe. That I don't remember. If that's the only restriction, that may be a good point. But in second also is the lineage of Jesus. Now, even though the second topic of this chapter is the sins of Judah, it is from the tribe of Judah that the Messiah still comes from. Even though it's almost incestuous because she is the wife of one of Judah's sons. Actually, two of the sons that never produce any seed. And she's supposed to be married off to a third. But it's almost incestuous.
How is it almost? I'm not sure I'm saying almost.
Because I don't like to say that it is incestuous.
Whether it is or it isn't. It has to be one.
Well, God doesn't call it that. I can't even spell it. I don't know. I don't.
I take.
It's just incestuous.
No, I take.
I'm going to hit you. And we're just looking at something that is so off the wall that it's going to take a miracle to fix. And it does. God does fix it. All right. So, as was discussed previously, the rights of the firstborn have passed on now to Judah. We've gone through and we've looked at Reuben, is it Reuben? Yeah. We got Reuben, then we have Simeon, Levi, and Judah. This is the birth order of the 12 tribes. Reuben's the firstborn, and he commits adultery and incest. It knocks him out. Simeon and Levi, both of these guys murder an entire village because of Dinah being raped, and they're knocked out of the ring. Judah's the next guy in order for God to get. Each time God's going to try and bring through somebody the Messiah. And Reuben should have been the one that the Messiah would come through, but Reuben knocked himself out of the ring. He was not qualified anymore. So God could have used Simeon or Levi, and both of them disqualified themselves. The next was Judah. You're watching how the devil comes in, knows that God's going to use the firstborn, and always, you have a firstborn son. That would be the hardest hit son. If you have five children, the one that the devil will try to knock down the most will be your firstborn. Try to work on all of them, but he will try to knock that down because your firstborn just has a special place in God. That child belongs to God, the first one through the womb. So he knocks that one out, then knocks out each one of them. Judah's next in the target. When the devil targets anybody, believe me, there's almost no recovery. And Judah was next to be destroyed so that God could not bring the Messiah through, but the Messiah comes through Judah.
It's more that he had a change of heart, though, isn't it? it's not really that what knocked out Reuben and Simeon and Levi was their adultery and murder and stuff, but it's more that they didn't repent.
Right. Every one of these, you're going to see every one of them sin.
Yeah.
But only this one gets right.
Right.
As with David. David sinned far worse than Saul ever did, didn't he? But David was a great repenter. And that kept him from being killed, kept him from being judged severely by God. All right, does that make sense? All right, so Judas, number E, after reading of the sins of Judah in this chapter, you can only wonder why he was not passed over as well. Well, the only answer is he admitted to and was repentant of his sins. He admitted to them. The devil here seeks to ruin God's plan of using such a rebel as Judah in the line of Messiah. The one way the devil has to do it is through the making it so that God has to curse a person that God seeks to use. It almost happened to Judah. And it did happen to Reuben. And it almost happened to all of Israel. When Israel leaves Egypt and heads to the Promised Land, Balaam is hired by Barak. And Barak wanted Balaam to curse Israel. Balaam couldn't do it. But Balaam says, were they Midianites or who were they? Who was Balak? Barak. Whatever nation they were, Balaam convinced them, if you give them your daughters, and if your daughters marry their sons, God will have to curse his people because God's people cannot intermingle. So all the time the devil's trying to get you to do something that will disqualify you. He'll try to put some picture in front of you. He'll try to put some opportunity in front of you to ruin you. And that's what he tries with Judah. Number A, Judah's shameful actions. Judah's shameful actions. And I forgot to list the scriptures, so let me see what we got to be reading here. Let's read verses 1 and 2 in Genesis 38. Romeo, if you're in Genesis 38, verses 1 and 2.
It came to pass at that time that Judah departed from his brothers and visited certain Adullamites whose name was Hirah. And Judah saw their daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he married her and went into her.
Okay, just holding there. So here's the shameful action. Judah, who does Abraham say his sons cannot marry? The Canaanites. And so he sends a servant to go and bring a wife from his family back in Syria. Isaac says, and Isaac and Rebekah say about Jacob, say, Jacob cannot marry. You've got to go back to Laban and get a wife from there. But where does Judah go to get a wife? Just down the road. Just among the people of the Canaanites.
Yes, sir. How do you know he married her? Because it says he took her. He went in on her.
She conceived and bare a son. It doesn't say that he had an official marriage, but that was good enough for marriage back then. That was marriage.
Didn't it do the same with Warren Sterling when he was describing Dina or Dina being raped? He took her and went in on her. Same thing, isn't it?
It is. But as far as I can tell from Judah's viewpoint, this was going to be his wife. He just didn't use the term wife. I take it, I know what you're saying now. I never thought about him as using it just as a harlot, because that's the only other option.
Yeah.
Okay. But, and he does use somebody else as a harlot later, so you make a point. But I wouldn't limit to that. I think this is his desire to have a wife, and he just picks the first girl that is available. And she's a nearby. And, I don't know. I'll just leave it. You're asking whether he actually married her. And I would say, I don't know. But I would count it that he's counting it as a marriage, even though he's doing it in disobedience. So the actions of Judah cannot be excused. For him to marry or even go in unto a woman of Canaan was a sin. What is interesting to note here is that God did not stand in Judah's way. God didn't stop him. And God won't stop you from sinning either. He will He will try and put roadblocks there, but he will allow you to do whatever you want. Now, there's a lesson for us here. We may be set on doing things our way, somewhat contrary to the will of God, like with Judah. And just because God stood in the way of Balaam is no sign that he will do it for us. He did not stand in Judah's way. God allowed Paul to go to Jerusalem after he was told it would cost him his life. God may or may not stand in our ways. It doesn't stop us. So what we have to decide is just how bad we want to do things our way. How bad do we want what we want? Judah wanted the Canaanite wife very badly. It appears he loved her very much, for he was grieved, and he becomes grieved at her death. And that regardless of how much he loved her, he still lost two of his children. Regardless of how much he loved her, he was still out of the God's will. So, look at Judah's children, 3-6. Back to you, Francis. 38 verses 3, 4, 5, 6.
And she conceived and bare a son, and he called his name Reuben. And she conceived again and bare a son, and she called his name Onan. And she yet again conceived, and she bare a son, and called his name Shelah. And he was at
Kezib
when she bare him.
And hold. One of the reasons why I know this is not a harlot, now that I take a look at it again, is he's staying with her. And he's having several children by her, okay? So he's married this woman, so he got two sons now at this point. Go ahead now. And I want you to be down to verse 12, if you don't, or verse 11. Keep going all the way down to verse 11.
Judah took a wife for her. His firstborn, his name was Tamar. And Judah's firstborn was wicked in the sight of the Lord. And the Lord is killed. And Judah said unto Onan, go into thy brother's wife, and marry her, and raise up seed to thy brother. And Onan knew that the seed should not be his. And it came to pass, when he went in unto his brother's wife, that he spilled it on the ground. That he should give it to his brother, and the things which he did displease the Lord, wherefore he slew him also. Then said Judah to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow at thy father's house, till Shelah, my son, be grown. For he said, this part will venture thy also. And as his brethren did, and Tamar went and dwelt in her father's house.
This has got to be one sad man. He's got a wife that he's married that's a Canaanite woman. She's not a believer. She doesn't care about anything but her own pagan gods. And Judah has two boys. Actually, he has three children. Onan, and what's the third child's name? Shua. All right, so the firstborn, he goes out and gets a wife for named Tamar. And her husband's a wicked man before the Lord, which means God, he wasn't just wicked, he was defiantly wicked before God. It doesn't tell you what he did, but it was enough for God to just strike him dead. So Judah then says to Onan, and he says, you've got to take responsibility for your brother's wicked. He did not take care of his wife. You take care of her. We don't have a government that takes care of widows. People do. So Onan goes in, but Onan says, but she's not my wife. I'm going to have children in my brother's name. And he doesn't even love this woman. He doesn't even want to sleep with her. Doesn't want to be with her. And so God says, I've had it up to here with you guys, and kills him. But then, you know what Judah says? Judah says to Tamar, I go home, stay at your father's house, stay a widow until my other son grows up, and let's see if God kills him. What a sad man. Judah's like, I think God's going to kill all my children. But if God doesn't kill him, you can have him. This is Judah. Can you imagine if we wrote the Bible like we talk? It is so sad. We're laughing, but it is beautiful.
It's kind of
paranoid.
He is paranoid. Well, he knows God's coming after him, okay? So let's go on down here. From verses 3 to 6, a period of about 23 years has passed in the life of Judah, allowing Ur to be about 20 years old when he marries. Judah's firstborn son is Ur, married a woman by the name of Tamar, and Tamar was a Canaanite, just like Judah's wife. Judah didn't even try to get his son to marry back into the family of Abraham. He has three children. The first one is Ur, E-R. To Ur is human. Needs another R on it. Ur, E-R is your first villain. Onan is the second one. It means strong. And the third one is Sheila. I said Sheila there. Ur is Sheila. It means petition or prayed for.
What's the last one?
Last one is Sheila. S-H-E-L-A-H. Or Shella. I'm not sure how it would be spelled. Probably Shella. I hate Sheila. Sheila's a female name. Shella. Kind of like Samuel was prayed for. Shella. Now the firstborn, Ur was so evil that God slew him. Just how deep Ur was into evil, we don't know. What we knew is that it displeased the Lord so much that he had to kill him. Is that a lesson for you and me? I don't want to ever cross a line where the Lord has to kill me. Out of fear. That's why I fear God. Right? I fear God and I fear my wife. You ought to, listen, you get into some sin, you ought to fear getting in trouble. Number four. To raise up seed is your filling. To raise up seed. This is going to be a revealed law from God. And it's accepted by God's people before the Mosaic laws were written down. After the death of Ur, Judah told his second son Onan to go in unto Tamar to give seed to the name of his brother Ur. These would be his children with his name and his inheritance. Knowing that the seed would never be his own, Onan didn't carry through with the command. And this also displeased the Lord, and Onan was killed. Why would Onan not obey? You see, Ur was the firstborn, and if Ur had not married, this is called the birthright. All of the family wealth from Judah, and Judah was getting very wealthy at this point, was going to Ur, and the family wealth would then pass to Onan.
You've got me something.
Wealth.
Thank you.
All that family wealth would have now passed to Onan. But because Ur had married, he and Tamar. Well, Onan now has to come up and play the place of Ur, but the family wealth would now bypass Onan and would go to Tamar and her sons. And Onan would still be a second-rate citizen. Onan was like, I don't want to give any children to Tamar. I want Tamar to die so I can get the wealth. God says, doomed. So he dies.
Straight up, because Tamar's son would be Onan's son.
No, they would not. That's the point. Onan would marry in the name of Ur, and those sons, that family wealth of Judah, the family wealth that was passing to Ur, was now going to go to the sons of Tamar as if Ur was still alive. And Onan would never have a name.
Physically, they'd still be his son.
I know, but to him, it wasn't worth it to have honor. It was worth it to have the money.
Yeah.
And he wanted the money to be in his name, not in his son's names. He wanted to enjoy the wealth. Okay?
And Tamar, is it?
Through Tamar, you see, Onan's going to have children through of Tamar, but the sons would be the sons of Ur still. Okay? And it's kind of a convoluted thing, but Onan wanted to marry his own girl and have his own wealth and let Tamar die so that the wealth would go into his life. Okay? His brother's dead, but his brother's name was going to still live on through that marriage. And his children would be known as sons of Ur, even though they were physically the sons of Onan. But they were brothers, so it would still be a coolant.
It says daughter-in-law there, though, doesn't it? Like, or an 11. Oh, yeah, we read it. You know, you were saying it's not incest or whatever, but he says daughter-in-law there. It says daughter-in-law there.
I just don't like to say it.
Is it more because it was kind of unbeknownst to Judah or whatever? that it's kind of, you know, that education.
I know it is, yes, and you're exactly right.
It is in my heart or whatever.
But it's still the fact that it happened. It's still the fact that Judah is so stupid spiritually that he would go to a harlot, and if he would be used by a harlot, who was actually his daughter-in-law, who didn't mind being used in order to manipulate him to give her Judah's son, Shelah. He's stuck in this midst because he put himself there.
Yeah, you don't know. It's his friend Hiram, so he just has the wrong friends like Amnon had the wrong friends.
He's got, yes.
So the Judah's sons are El-O and Shelah. And Tamar is wife, is it?
That's hers.
Say again? Tamar is married to Ur first.
Okay. And Ur passed away.
And Ur was murdered. Or was killed by God. Okay. So Ur is dead.
Ur is dead. Gone.
All right, dead and gone. So the family wealth should have gone to Onan, but instead Judah's still alive. Judah says, Onan, take the place of Ur and remarry Tamar. Onan wanted to go and marry his own wife. He wanted Tamar out of the scene so that that family wealth would come and through his children, and his own family would have the family wealth, but instead it was going to go from Ur and Tamar. These two were going to have now children, sons or whatever, and the wealth would come that way, and Onan would have nothing. Onan would just be filling a spot. He's filling the role of Ur, and he's mad, and he's angry that he's not allowed to get his own name.
Okay, nothing is gained.
Nothing's gained. So quickly, Judah's third son is Shelah, Shelah. Now, Shelah was too young to marry, maybe just by a few years. So Judah's determined to have a child in his name. Now, Judah wants to have one of his children survive. He commands Tamar to remain a widow and wait until Shelah is ready. Now, here's the death of Judah's wife. Look in verse 12. It says this. And in the process of time, the daughter of Shua, Judah's wife, so they are buried, that is his wife. All right. See, I take it for granted, and then he asks a question. I go, I don't know. I knew. But anyway, the Bible always clears up my confusion.
Verse 2 and verse 6. Verse 2 says that Judah took a wife, and then it says Judah took a wife.
Doesn't say verse 2.
No, verse 2 says he took her.
Just took
her. It says he took a wife, you know.
So took. But sometimes you might think he just took her like a harlot, but no, he actually took her to wife. Yes. So sometimes there are clues. But thankfully, the Bible clears up confusion. And in the process of time, the daughter of Shua, Judah's wife, died, and Judah was comforted and went up unto his sheep shearers in Timnath, and he and his friend Hira, the Adullamite. So he's comforted, but that's not all the great thing here. Let's keep going here. I want to go down to... Let's read down 13 and 13 to 23, Edward.
And it was told Tamar, saying, Behold, thy father-in-law goeth up to Timnah to share his sheep. And she put her widow's garments off from her and covered her a veil and wrapped herself and sat in an open place which is by the way to Timnah. And for she saw that Shelah was grown and she was not given unto him to wife. When Judah saw her, he thought her to be a harlot, because she had covered her face.
Isn't that weird? Today, they want to protect their women over there in the Middle East, so they cover the face. Whereas then, they covered their face to say, I'm a mysterious woman. It's weird. Go ahead.
You have to pay to see what they look like. You have to pay to see what they look like.
I guess so. That's right.
Surprise!
Surprise is right. How many warts can you count?
And he turned unto her by faith and said, Go to and pray thee, let me come in unto thee. For he knew not that she was his daughter-in-law. And she said, What wilt thou give me, that thou mayest come in unto me? And he said, I will send thee a kid from the flock. And she said, Wilt thou give me a pledge till thou send it? And he said, What pledge shall I give thee? And she said, Thy signet, and thy bracelet, and thy staff that is in thy hand. And he gave her it, and he gave it her, and came in unto her, and she conceived by him. And she arose and went away and laid by her veil from her, and put on the garments of her widowhood.
Hold there, right there. We'll just stop there for a second. I decided to stop at 19. After the death of his wife, Judah, Judah goes to Timnath, and he's shearing his sheep. But by this time, Shelah is old enough to take a wife, and is Judah keeping his promise? No. He's worried about, he's sad about losing his wife. He's sad about now being lonely and being alone. He's back thinking about himself. He's shearing the sheep. He's going to make some money, make more money. And I'm going to speak quite plainly, and I'm being recorded, so I got to be careful. But Tamar she's now fertile. She wants a child, and she wants a husband. And so she goes and sits by the wayside and says, I'm going to make that man do what he promised. The way he's going to do, she's going to do it. She's going to take advantage of a man's urge. And Judah, at number two, at this time that Tamar decides to take matters into her own hands, and she's going to secure the rights of the firstborn. Believe me, instead of getting Shelah, she's going to go back to the source and get Judah to give her children if she has to, so that she can get her. She wants to make sure she's taken care of. I mean,
She was dressed up like a harlot on purpose to deceive Judah into thinking she was a harlot.
Well, she would be glad to get Shelah or Judah. Doesn't matter, as long as she gets children and as long as her children are taken care of. That's an animalistic, protect your flock urge that's in people, whether they're male or female. Okay, so she's gonna use him because he hasn't given Shelah to marry. She's gonna use Judah now. Listen, she gets pregnant on one occasion, and usually women are very protective. They say, "I know I'm fertile. I better stay away." Because they didn't have birth control at all, but she knows I could get pregnant this way, and she times it perfectly, and she deceives. Judah. She dresses like a harlot, and believe me, harlots dress differently than a godly woman. No woman should dress so that a man has to guess whether she's available or not. And Judah makes a pledge. Judah wanted to take pleasure from Tamar. Not having any money to complete the deal, or not having goats to go with it, or food, or whatever, Judah pledged to send Tamar a kid goat in exchange for her services. And she doesn't trust him, for he's already lied about giving her his youngest son. So she asks of a signet, which is a ring, a bracelet, and his staff. Verses 20 to 30, Barry, and we'll try to finish up real quick.
And Judah sent the kid by the hand of his friend, the Edomite. Received his pledge from the woman's hand, but he found her not. Then he asked the men of that place, saying, Where is the harlot that was openly by the wayside? And they said, There was no harlot in this place.
Wow.
And he returned to Judah and said, I cannot find her. And also the men of the place said that there was no harlot in this place. And Judah says, Let her take it to her, lest we be shamed. Behold, I sent this kid, and thou hast not found her. And it came to pass about 3 months after that, I was told Judah, saying, Tamar, thy daughter-in-law, hath played the harlot, and also, behold, she is with child by whoredom. And Judah said, Bring her forth, and let her be burnt.
Let her be what?
Burnt.
She's played the harlot, and he decides, Let's burn her. You know, the most self-righteous people are those who've already committed the very same sin. Be very careful. I mean, there are times where you have to stand up against sin, but be careful that your hands aren't full of the same sin. All right, keep going.
When she was brought forth, she sent to her father-in-law, saying, "By the man whose these are, am I with child?" And she said, "Discern, I pray thee, whose are these, the signet and bracelets and staff?"
Hold. So where is she standing? Is she in a private audience with Judah?
No, it's publicly.
She has been publicly brought before a lot of men.
Oops.
And she says, "I'll tell you who I'm pregnant by." And she holds up a staff, a ring, and some bracelets. She said, "This is the man by whom I am pregnant." Can you imagine how little Judah now feels? Go ahead.
Judah acknowledged them and said, "She hath been more righteous than I."
She has? She's the harlot. She deceived him. She tricked him. She lured him. And he says, "I'm guilty, not her." That's repentance. Repentance doesn't blame anybody, even though she is to blame, isn't she? She's got plenty of blame, but he's got more. And he takes the whole thing, doesn't he? Wow. Go ahead.
"Because that I gave her not to Sheila, my son, and he knew her again no more."
Mm.
"And it came to pass in the time of her travail that the old twins were in her womb. And it came to pass when she travailed that the one put out his hand, and the midwife took and bound upon his hand a scarlet thread, saying, 'This came out first.' And it came to pass as he drew back his hand, that behold, his brother came out. And she said, 'How hast thou broken forth? This breach be upon thee.' Therefore his name was called Perez. And afterward came out his brother that had the scarlet thread upon his hand, and his name was called Zarah."
Okay. So Perez, when you look at that list as I showed you, through Judah and Tamar, look at this one woman's design was of the devil to get Judah, to give her a son. And because Judah gets right, Tamar never does. Through Perez, the firstborn, we get the Messiah. I mean, if a Jew wanted to find some fault in the Messiah, you could find it in his lineage. But that's how God works. God works through sinners. It's an amazing thing. So number D is conception, deception, and confession. You write down next to there, repentance. Man, oh man, oh man. Anyway, conclusion and applications here. The lineage of Jesus from Adam to Perez, you run down there. I've got some estimated times. Just look, start from Adam, Seth, Enos, Canaan, all the way down. You get Perez. He's 25th from Adam. David is 34th. You got 600 years from Perez down to David. Consider the family tree of Jesus. How many skeletons are hanging in his closet? Consider the sins of Adam, Noah, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, now Judah. These are just the ones recorded thus far. You've got Rahab. You've got Bathsheba. These are people in Jesus' lineage and his genealogy. What kind of people are in your... I've got a criminal in my background. I've also got a great warrior who died in the Alamo. Named George Lamb. He's a distant great uncle. But I've got some messed up people in my background. You probably do too, you know. So... To study how Satan deceived God's people with sin, you got to study the entire Old Testament. The majority of the Jewish kings were evil and they worshipped false gods for over 4,000 years of recorded history throughout the Old Testament. It was a constant battle waged by Satan. He tried everything in his power to contaminate the Jewish race to prevent the birth of the Messiah. But there is a scarlet thread from Genesis to Matthew that reveals the lineage of Jesus. Now here's the points to ponder. What were the consequences of Judah taking a wife in Canaan? What was one of the... Give me some consequences.
Sons died.
Yeah, 2 out of 3 of his sons died. Sheila is never heard of, never used by God at all. All right. Another woman, Tamar.
He could have died.
Well, it doesn't say, but he could have died. I know Judah does have children because Judah is a tribe, so Judah has to have more children.
It polluted the bloodline?
It kind of did, but God was able to fix it. Okay. Hey, Jacob married two servants, they were servants of Rachel and Leah. So I don't know if those servants were black or not, but he married them, and they were their children are tribes of Israel. So even though that they're not purebred,
Joseph married an Egyptian.
And Joseph married an Egyptian. So including the line was through spiritual things as much as through physical. There are a lot of consequences. I mean, Judah was taken advantage of and almost lost everything. What's the difference between a woman getting pregnant in 2014 and 2,500 years ago? They would have gotten stoned back then. Today, it's like, oh, that's wonderful. Does he have a father? No, you don't know. Okay, well, God bless you. Oh, man.
That's exactly what I meant. God bless you.
I know. Is a Levirate marriage a good or a bad thing?
Bad thing. It's supposed to be.
It's bad for the brother. I think if we tried to live simply, without the government taking care of every one of our mistakes and because of everything, you know, there's only a couple of things you can do to either it's the father's responsibility to take care of every one of his daughter's laws. Or you say, all right, take one of the brothers. I just know that God had a way to keep Israel. It wasn't enforced to a huge degree, but it was something they took very seriously.
Was it only if the brother wasn't married already?
Well, the brother to marry couldn't be married. So Onan could not have been married already to take, as far as I know, to take his brother's wife. Yeah. Now, whether if the woman had children or not, I don't know. There's some things I don't understand. Recap the lineage of Jesus so far, beginning with Adam. And remember, the human history is about 2,200 years of time from Adam to Jesus. 2,200 years of history. And the lesson that I want you to learn from the historical events are this, that God uses ordinary people. God uses sinners to do extraordinary things. That's what I want you to learn so far. God uses ordinary people to do extraordinary things, even though they fail. Now, you have an exam next week.
I just had a quick question. You know, the nearer of kin than Boaz, right, who was nearer of kin, and he said, lest I mar my inheritance. Would that might have meant that he actually had a wife already or something like that?
I don't know. His inheritance, in that situation, you've got... I'm not sure I can actually do an accurate tree because I haven't thought about it in a long time.
Yeah.
Boaz and this other kinsman.
Yeah.
All right. To Naomi, you got Naomi and her husband, Ruth's husband, whoever he was related to Boaz and to this other kinsman.
Yeah.
And the kinsman, I've got him reversed, the kinsman was nearer to the husband. But whether he was a cousin or a brother, I don't know. It doesn't say brother, it says kinsman, which means family member. So they might have been an extended family. I don't know. Why you would say nearer, I would say by family, meaning you've got brothers, and then you've got cousins, and then distant cousins, and somehow, I'm thinking this kinsman was a cousin, and Boaz was a more distant cousin. That's always been my guess. But whether they were brothers, I don't know. Because if they had been brothers, it didn't matter. It's just the next brother who's available, as far as I could tell. But this kinsman had his own inheritance. I'm saying he had his own father,
right?
And he had his own inheritance. And if he married, all of that wealth would have gone through Ruth and her children. And that's what he would have lost. And Boaz was not worried about losing anything because he fell in love with Ruth. That's kind of cool. Okay, next week you have a test. You ready, Francis? Review your materials. It's not your major exam, but it is a review of these last chapters from chapters 30 through 38. Review most everything that's underlined already that you had to fill in. You're going to want to be aware of and know. Some of the things, like ages, are not so particular, but take a look, and we'll take our test. Take a quick break, and we'll go back for angiology. It took a long time, but it was necessary.